Yes. If this happened, well, maybe anything can. He puts his hands on my shoulders and gently pushes me away.
You have no idea how much it's killing me to say no, Oliver says. But I've got an opening argument to write, and my client's mother is, well, incredibly demanding.
No kidding, I say. He sits up and pulls my camisole out from under his head, helps me stretch it over my head.
This isn't nearly as much fun in reverse, he points out.
We both dress, and then Oliver frees Thor from his banishment and hooks a leash onto his collar, offering to walk me partway home. We're the only people on the streets at this hour. I feel like an idiot, I say, glancing down at my slippers and my pajama bottoms.
You look like a college student.
I roll my eyes. You are such a liar.
You mean lawyer.
Is there a difference? I stop walking and look up at him. This, I say, not in front of Jacob. Oliver doesn't pretend to misunderstand me. He keeps walking, tugging at Thor's leash.
All right, he says.
We part ways at the skateboarding park, and I walk quickly with my head ducked against the wind and the view of drivers and passing cars. Every now and then, a smile bubbles up from inside me, rising to the surface. The closer I get to home, the more inappropriate that feels, as if I'm cheating somehow, as if I have the audacity to be someone other than the mother I'm expected to be. By 6:15, I'm turning the corner of my street, relieved. Jacob wakes up like clockwork at 6:30. He'll be none the wiser. But as I get closer, I see that the lights are on in the house, and my heart skips a beat. I start running, panicked. What if something happened to Jacob in the middle of the night? How stupid have I been leaving him? I hadn't scribbled a note, I hadn't taken my cell phone, and as I throw open the front door, I'm nearly bent double by the weight of what might have gone wrong. Jacob stands at the kitchen counter, already making his own brown breakfast. There are two place settings.
Mom, he blurts, excited. You'll never guess who's here.
Before I can, though, I hear the downstairs toilet flush and the running of the faucet and the footsteps of the guest, who enters the kitchen with an uncomfortable smile. Henry, I say.
Case 10. Wouldn't you like to get away with murder? On November 19, 1986, Hella Crafts, a Pan Am flight attendant from Connecticut, disappeared. Her husband was suspected shortly after she vanished. Richard Crafts told authorities that he hadn't left the house on November 19th, but credit card records showed that he'd purchased new bedding. Shortly before his wife disappeared, he also bought a large freezer and rented a wood chipper. When a witness recalled seeing a wood chipper near the Housatonic River, police searched the Crafts' home. Blood found on the mattress matched Hella's. A letter addressed to Hella was found near the Housatonic, and divers recovered a chainsaw and cutting bar, which still had human hair and tissue in its jaws. Based on this, a more thorough evidence search was begun. Here's what they found. 2,660 hairs, one fingernail, one toenail, one tooth cap, 5 droplets of blood. A fingernail in a U-Haul rented by Crafts chemically matched nail polish in Hella's bathroom, too, but it was thrown out of court because of the lack of a search warrant. From this evidence, in 1989, Crafts was found guilty of his wife's murder and sentenced to 99 years in prison. This case made Dr. Henry Lee famous, Leave it to him, a forensic hero, to secure a murder conviction, even without a body.
Chapter 10. Emma. For just a moment, I'm certain that I'm hallucinating. My ex-husband is not standing in my kitchen, is not coming forward to awkwardly kiss my cheek. "What are you doing here?" I demand. He looks at Jacob, who's pouring chocolate soy milk into a glass.
"For once in my life, I wanted to do the right thing," Henry says.
I fold my arms. "Don't flatter yourself, Henry. This has less to do with Jacob than it does with your own guilt."
"Wow," he says. "Some things never change."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"No one's allowed to be a better parent than you are. You have to be the gold standard, and if you're not, you'll cut everyone else down to make sure of it."
"That's pretty funny coming from a man who hasn't seen his son in years."
3 years, 6 months, and 4 days,"
Jacob says. I had forgotten he was still in the room.
"We went out to dinner in Boston because you flew in for work. You ate beef tenderloin and you sent it back because it was too rare at first."
Henry and I look at each other. "Jacob," I say, "why don't you go upstairs and take the first shower?"
"What about breakfast?"
"You can eat it when you come back down." Jacob hustles upstairs, leaving me alone with Henry. "You have got to be kidding," I say, furious. "You think you can just show up here like some white knight and save the day?"
"Considering that I'm the one who cut the check for the lawyer,"
Henry says, "I have a right to make sure he's doing his job."
That, of course, makes me think of Oliver and the things we did that were not job-related.
"Look," Henry says, the bluster falling from him like snow from a tree limb.
"I didn't come here to make things more difficult for you, Emma. I came to help."
"You don't just get to be their father now because your conscience reared its ugly head. You're either a father 24/7 or not at all."
"Why don't we ask the kids if they want me to stick around or leave?"
"Oh, right. That's like dangling a brand new video game in front of them. You're a novelty, Henry."
He smiles a little. "Can't remember the last time I've been accused of that."
There's a commotion as Theo clatters down the stairs.
"Wow, you are here," he says. "Weird."
"It's because of you," Henry replies. "After you came all the way to see me, I realized I couldn't sit at home and pretend this wasn't happening."
Theo snorts a laugh.
"Why not? I do it all the time."
"I'm not listening to this," I say, moving around the kitchen. "We have to be in court by 9:30.
"I'll come," Henry said, "for moral support."
"Thank you so much," I say dryly. "I don't know how I'd get through the day if you weren't here. Oh, wait, I've gotten through 5,000 days without you here." Theo skirts between us and opens the refrigerator. He pulls out a carton of grapefruit juice and drinks directly from it.
"Gosh, what a happy little family unit we are."
He glances overhead as the water in the pipe stops running.
"I call the shower next,"
he says, and he heads back upstairs. I sink down into a chair. "So, how does this work? You sit in the courtroom and act concerned while your real family is waiting just outside the escape hatch?"
"That's not fair, Emma."
"Nothing's fair."
"I'm here for as long as I need to be. Meg understands that I've got a responsibility to Jacob."
"Right, a responsibility. But somehow she's neglected to invite him to sunny California to meet his stepsisters."
"Jacob won't get on a plane, and you know it." So your plan is to just come step into his life and then step out of it again after the trial?
I don't have a plan.
What about afterward?
That's why I came.
He takes a step closer.
If the worst happens and Jacob doesn't come home, well, I know you'll be there for him to lean on,
Henry says.
But I thought you might need someone to lean on too.
There are 100 comebacks running through my head, most of which ask why I would trust him now when he has a track record of abandoning me. But instead I shake my head. Jacob's coming home, I say.
Emma, you have to...
I hold up the flat of my hand, as if I can stop his words midstream. Help yourself to breakfast. I need to get dressed. I leave him sitting in the kitchen, and I go upstairs to my bedroom. Through the wall, I can hear Theo singing in the shower. I sit down on the bed, clasp my hands between my knees. When the boys were little, we had house rules. I'd write them on the bathroom mirror when they were in the tub so that the next time the room steamed up, they would magically appear. Commandments for a toddler and his painfully literal autistic brother. Laws that were not to be broken. 1. Clean up your own messes. 2. Tell the truth. 3. Brush your teeth twice a day. 4. Don't be late for school. 5. Take care of your brother. He's the only one you've got. One night, Jacob had asked me if I had to follow the rules too, and I said yes. But, he pointed out, you don't have a brother. Then I will take care of you, I said. However, I didn't. Oliver will stand up in court today, and maybe the next day and the next, and try to accomplish what I have unsuccessfully tried to do for 18 years now. Make strangers understand what it's like to be my son. Make them feel sympathy for a child who cannot feel it himself. When Theo's done in the bathroom, I go in. The air is still thick with heat and steam. The mirror's fogged. I can't see the tears on my face, but it's for the best. Because I may know my son, and I may believe viscerally that he is not a murderer. But the odds of a jury seeing this as clearly as I do are minimal. Because no matter what I tell Henry, or myself for that matter, I know that Jacob isn't coming home.
Jacob. Theo is still getting dressed when I knock on his door. What the fuck, dude? He says, holding up a towel to his body. I close my eyes until he tells me it's okay to look, and then I walk into his room. I need help with my tie, I say. I'm very proud of the fact that I got dressed today without any issues. I was a little freaked out by the buttons on the shirt, which felt like hot coals on my chest, but I put on a t-shirt underneath, and now it isn't quite as painful. Theo stands in front of me in his jeans and a sweatshirt. I wish I could wear that to the courthouse. He straightens my collar and starts to loop the ends of the tie around and around so that it will be a tie instead of the knot I've managed to make twice. The tie is like a long, skinny knit scarf. I like it a lot more than the stupid striped thing Oliver made me wear yesterday. There you go, Theo says. Then he hunches his shoulders. So, what do you think about Dad? I don't think about Dad, I say. I mean, about him being here? Oh, I say. I guess it's good. In reality, I don't think it's either good or bad. It's not as if it's going to make much difference after all. But it seems like normal people would have a more positive reaction to seeing a close family member. And he did travel 3,000 miles on a plane, so I have to give him credit for that. I thought Mom was going to blow her stack. I don't know what he means by that, but I nod and smile at him. You'd be surprised how far that response can get you in a conversation where you're completely confused. Do you remember him? Theo asks. He called on my birthday, and that was only 3.5 months ago. No, Theo interrupts. I mean, do you remember him from back then, when he lived with us? I do, actually. I remember being in bed between him and my mother, and holding my hand up to his cheek while he slept. It was scratchy with incoming beard, and the texture used to intrigue me. Plus, I liked the sound it made when he scraped it. I remember his briefcase. He had floppy disks inside in different colors that I liked to sort by spectrum, and paper clips in a small container that I would line up on the floor of his office while he worked. Sometimes, though, when he was doing programming and got stuck or excited, he yelled. And that usually made me yell, and he would call for my mother to take me so that he could get some work done. He took me apple picking once, I say. He let me ride on his shoulders and showed me how the apple pickers get the apples out of their baskets without bruising them. For a while, I kept a list of apple facts as I learned them, because what I remembered about my father was that he at least had a passing interest in pomology, enough of one to take me out to an orchard for the day. I know, for example, that 1. The world's top apple producers are China, the United States, Turkey, Poland, and Italy. 2. It takes about 36 apples to create a gallon of cider. 3. Red Delicious is the most widely grown variety in the United States. 4. It takes the energy of 50 leaves to produce a single apple. 5. The largest apple ever picked weighed 3 pounds. 6. Apples float because a quarter of their volume is air. 7. Apple trees are related to roses. 8. Archaeologists have found evidence of apples being eaten as early as 6,500 BC. That's cool, Theo says. I don't remember anything about him at all. I know why. It's because Theo was only a few months old when my father left. I don't remember that day, but I do remember a lot leading up to it. My mother and father often fought right in front of me. I was there, but I wasn't there. Those were the days when I would find myself completely entranced by the static on the television screen, or the lever of the toaster. My parents assumed that I wasn't paying attention, but that isn't the way it works. I could hear and see and smell and feel everything at once back then, which is why I had to focus so hard to pay attention to only one of the stimuli. I've always sort of pictured it like a movie. Imagine a camera that can record the entire world at once, every sight, every sound. That's very impressive, but it isn't particularly useful if you want to specifically hear a conversation between two people, or see a ball coming toward you while you're standing at bat. And yet, I couldn't change the brain I'd been born with, so instead, I learned how to narrow the world with makeshift blinders, until all I noticed was what I wanted to notice. That's autism, for those who've never been there themselves. Anyway, this is also why, even though my parents might have assumed my attention was otherwise occupied, I can remember the fights they had verbatim. You remember me, Emma? I live here too. For God's sake, Henry, are you really jealous of the time I spend with your own son? And I don't care how we're going to pay for it. I'm not going to pass up a treatment for Jacob just because. Because what? Say it. You don't think I make enough money. Your words, not mine. and I want to come home from my fucking job to my fucking house and not have 10 fucking strangers on my living room floor. Is that so much to ask? Those strangers are the ones who are going to bring Jacob back to us. Wake up, Emma. He is what he is. There's not some miracle locked inside him waiting to come out. And you've worked late every night this week. Well, what have I got to come home to? And what do you mean you're pregnant? We said no more. We already have too much on our plate. I didn't exactly get pregnant by myself, you know. You'd know. You're the one who takes the pills. You think I tricked you? Jesus, Henry, I'm glad to know you think so highly of me. Just get out. Get out of here. And one day, he did. Suddenly, my father knocks on Theo's door and pokes his head into the room. Boys, he says, how are you doing? Neither of us says a word. Jacob, he asks, can we talk? We sit down in my room, with me on the bed and my father on my desk chair. Are you okay with me being here? I look around. He isn't messing anything up on my desk, so I nod. This makes him feel better, I think, because his shoulders relax. I owe you an apology, he says. I don't really know how to put this into words. That happens to me, I tell him. He smiles a little and shakes his head. Theo looks so much like him. I've heard this all my life from my mother, but now I can also see that there's a lot of my father that reminds me of me. Like the way he ducks his head before he starts a sentence, and how he drums his fingers on his thighs. I wanted to apologize to you, Jacob, he says. There are some people, like your mother, who just won't give up. I'm not one of those people. I'm not saying it's an excuse, only a fact. I knew enough about myself even back then to understand that this wasn't a situation I could handle. By this, I say, you mean me. He hesitates, and then he nods. I don't know as much about Asperger's as your mother does, he says. But I think maybe we've all got something in us that keeps us from connecting to people, even when we want to. I like the concept, that Asperger's is like a flavoring added to a person, and although my concentration is higher than those of others, if tested, everyone else would have traces of this condition too. I make myself look my father in the eye. Did you know apples can rust? I say. No, he says, his voice softer. No, I did not. In addition to the list of apple facts, I've kept another list for my father, of questions I might ask if the chance arose. 1. If it hadn't been for me, would you have stayed? 2. Were you ever sorry you left? 3. Do you think one day we could be friends? 4. If I promised to try harder, would you consider coming back? It's worthwhile to note that while we were sitting in my room, we discussed apples, the medical examiner's testimony of yesterday, and the article in Wired magazine about whether Asperger's was on the rise in Silicon Valley due to the preponderance of math and science genes in the geographical area. Yet I didn't ask him a single one of these questions, which are still on a list in the back of my bottommost left desk drawer. We all ride to the courthouse together in my father's rental car. It's silver and smells like pine trees. I'm sitting in my usual seat in the back behind my father, who's driving. My mother sits next to him, and Theo's beside me. As we drive, I look at the spaces between the power lines on the telephone poles, which narrow at the ends and then widen in the middle, like giant canoes. We're 5 minutes from the courthouse when my mother's cell phone rings. She nearly drops it before she manages to answer the call. "I'm fine," she says, but her face gets red. "We'll meet you in the parking lot." I suppose I should be nervous, but I'm actually excited. Today is the day that Oliver gets to tell everyone the truth about what I did. "Now, Jacob," my mother says, "you remember the rules." "Let Oliver do the talking," I mutter. "Pass him a note if I need a break. I'm not a moron, Mom." "That's a matter of opinion," Theo says. She twists around in her seat. Her pupils are large and dark, and a pulse beats in the hollow of her throat. "It's going to be harder for you today," she says quietly. "You're going to hear things said about you that might not make sense. Things that maybe you even think aren't true. But just remember, Oliver knows what he's doing."
"Is Jacob testifying?" my father asks.
My mother turns to him. "What do you think?"
"I was just asking, for God's sake."
"Well, you can't come in at the third act and expect me to tell you what you've missed," she snaps. And silence fills the car like sarin gas. I start to whisper the Fibonacci sequence under my breath to make myself feel better. And Theo must feel the same way because he says,
"So, are we there yet?"
And then laughs hysterically as if he's told a really funny joke. As we drive in, Oliver is leaning against his truck. It's an old pickup that, he says, is more suited to a farrier than an attorney, but it still gets him from point A to point B. We're parked in the back of the courthouse, away from the cameras and the television news vans. He glances up as we drive by. But this isn't my mother's car, so he doesn't realize it's us. It isn't until we park and step out of the rental car that Oliver sees my mother and comes forward with a big smile on his face. And then he notices my dad.
"Oliver," my mother says, "this is my ex-husband, Henry."
"Are you kidding?" Oliver looks at my mother. My father sticks out his hand to shake Oliver's. "Nice to meet you."
Right. Pleasure."
Then he turns to me.
"Oh, for the love of God, Emma, I can't let him go into the courtroom like this."
I look down. I'm wearing brown corduroy pants and a brown shirt, with a brown tweed blazer and the stretchy brown tie that Theo tied for me. "It's Thursday, and he's dressed in a jacket and tie," my mother says tightly. "You might imagine that this morning I had a lot on my plate." Oliver turns to my father. "What does he look like to you?" "A UPS driver," my father says.
"I was thinking Nazi," Oliver shakes his head.
"We don't have time for you to go home and change, and you're too big to fit into my..."
Suddenly, he breaks off and sizes up my father with one glance.
"Go trade shirts with him in the bathroom."
"But it's white," I say.
"Exactly. The look we're going for is not modern-day serial killer, Jake."
My father glances at my mother.
"See?" he says. "Aren't you glad I came?"
The first day I met Jess for social skills training, I happened to be fearing for my very life. I had been in Mrs. Wicklow's English class that year. It wasn't a particularly interesting class, and Mrs. Wicklow had the bad fortune to have a face that looked a little like a sweet potato, long and narrow, with a few sprouting hairs at the chin and an orange spray-on tan. But she always let me read aloud when we were doing plays, even if I sometimes had trouble remembering my place. And the time I forgot my notebook, on the day of the open book exam, she let me take it the next day. One day, when she was out with the flu, a boy in the class named Sawyer Trigg, who had been suspended once for bringing NyQuil to school to sell in the cafeteria, ignored the substitute teacher and plucked bits of the spider plant off, then stuck it to his chin with gum. He jammed wadded-up paper under his shirt and started prancing through the aisles between our desk.
"I'm Mrs. Wicklow,"
he said, and everyone laughed. I laughed too, but only to fit in. Because you're supposed to respect teachers, even if they're not there. So when Mrs. Wicklow came back, I told her what Sawyer had been doing, and she sent him to the principal. Later that day, he slammed me up against my locker and said, "I could fucking kill you, Hunt." Well, I spent the rest of the day in an utter panic. Because he could kill me, I had no doubt of that. And when Jess arrived at the school to meet me for the first time, I had a butter knife in my pocket, stolen from the cafeteria. The best I could do on short notice, just in case Sawyer Trigg was lurking in the shadows of the hallways. She told me that what I said to her was private, and that she wouldn't tell my mother about anything I wanted to keep a secret between us. I liked that. It sounded like having a best friend, at least the way it's always portrayed on television. But I was too distracted to comment. Jacob? Jess said, when she caught me looking over my shoulder for the eighth time. Is everything okay? That was when I told her everything about Mrs. Wicklow and Sawyer Trigg. She shook her head. He's not going to kill you. But he said, that's his way of letting you know he's mad at you for tattling on him. You're not supposed to make fun of teachers. You're not supposed to tell on your peers either, Jess said, especially if you want them to like you. I mean, Mrs. Wicklow has to be nice to you, it's part of her contract. But you have to earn the trust of your classmates, and you just lost that. She leaned forward. There are all kinds of rules, Jacob. Some of them are explicit, like not making fun of teachers. But others are like secrets. They're the ones you're supposed to know, even if they never get said. That was exactly what I never seemed to understand. Those unwritten rules that other people seemed to pick up as if they had a social radar device that was missing in my own brain. Did you laugh when Sawyer made fun of Mrs. Wicklow? Yes. He thought you were on his side, that you were enjoying the performance, so imagine how he felt when you tattled on him. I stared at Jess. I wasn't Sawyer, and I had been adhering to a rule, whereas he was deliberately breaking one. I can't, I said. A few minutes later, my mother came to pick me up. Hello, she said, smiling at Jess. How did it go? Jess looked at me, making sure she caught my eye. Then she turned to my mother. Jacob got another boy in trouble today. Oh, and he stole a knife from the school cafeteria. I felt my heart go to stone in my chest, and my mouth was dry as cotton. I thought this girl was going to be my friend, was going to keep my secrets. And the first thing she did was turn around and tell my mother everything that had happened today? I was furious. I never wanted to see her again. And I felt soft and spongy in my stomach, too, as if I had just gotten off an amusement park ride, because I knew my mother was going to want to follow up on this conversation on the drive home. Jess touched my arm to get my attention. That, she said, is how Sawyer felt. And I will never do that to you again. Will you? The next day, I went to school, and I waited near Sawyer's locker. What are you doing here, prick? He asked. I'm sorry, I told him, and I really, truly meant it. Maybe it was my face, or the tone of my voice, or just the fact that I sought him out. But he stood there for a second, with his locker open, and then he shrugged. Whatever, Sawyer said. I decided that this was his way of saying thanks. Are you still thinking of killing me? He shook his head and laughed. I don't think so. I'm telling you, Jess Ogilvy was the best teacher I've ever had. And she would have understood, better than anyone, why I had to do what I did.
Oliver. What happened last night was the single most remarkable experience of my sexual history, unless you count the time I was a sophomore in college and got a letter published in Penthouse. The difference being, of course, that that was fictional, whereas last night really happened. I've been thinking about it. Okay, I've been thinking of nothing but it. Once Emma and I had both admitted our biggest fears to each other, we were on equal footing. Vulnerability trumps age. When you're emotionally bare, the leap to being physically bare isn't all that far. I woke up this morning with her hair loose over my arm and her body warm against mine, and I decided that I didn't care if she had slept with me out of desperation or frustration or even distraction. I wasn't going to let her go. I had charted every inch of her last night. I wanted to return to that territory until I knew it better than anyone ever had or ever would. Which meant I had to get her son acquitted, because otherwise, she'd never want to see me again. To that end, I came to court this morning intending to give Jacob the best defense in the history of the state of Vermont. I was single-minded and focused and determined, until I saw her emerge from another man's car. Her ex's. He has a right to be here, I suppose. He's Jacob's father. But Emma had led me to believe that he wasn't really in the picture. I don't like the way Henry held on to her when we were walking up the steps of the courthouse. I don't like the fact that he's bigger than I am. I don't like the fact that the one time I touched Emma's arm as we were about to come into the courtroom, Theo saw me do it, and his brows shot up to his hairline, so I had to immediately pretend it was an accidental brush of the hand. I really don't like the fact that I'm preoccupied with Emma when I ought to be focused solely on her son. As the jury files in, I take my seat beside Jacob. He looks like he's had 60 cups of coffee. He's bouncing, even though he's seated next to me at the defense table. Emma is on his right side, and I swear, I can feel the heat of her skin, even with her son between us. "I don't like this," Jacob mutters. "You and me both, kid," I think. "What don't you like?" "Her hair." "Whose hair?" "Hers," Jacob says, and he points to Helen Sharp without glancing at her. Today, the prosecutor is wearing her hair loose around her face. It's auburn and brushes her shoulders. It actually makes her look almost compassionate, although I know better. "Well," I say, "it could be worse." "How?" "It could be longer." This makes me think of Emma last night, with her hair free and falling down her back. I'd never seen it like that because of Jacob. "It's a bad omen," Jacob says, and his fingers flutter on his thigh. "There seems to be a lot of that going around," I say, and I turn to Emma. "What's Henry doing here?" She shakes her head. "He showed up this morning when I was out for my run," she stresses and doesn't meet my eye. Conversation closed. "Make sure you tell the truth," Jacob states, and Emma and I both jerk our heads toward him. Is Jacob more intuitive than either of us gave him credit for? "All rise," the bailiff says, and the judge strides in from his chambers. "If the defense wishes to deliver an opening statement," Judge Cutting says, "you may begin." I would have preferred to give my opening statement back when Helen had given hers, so that the whole time the jury was watching Jacob's reactions during the prosecution's turn, they could have been thinking his inappropriate effect was because he has Asperger's, not because he is a sociopathic killer. But the judge didn't give me that opportunity, and so now I just have to leave an impression that's twice as deep. "The truth," Jacob whispers again. "You'll tell them what happened, right?" He is talking about the jury, I realize. He is talking about Jess's murder. And there is so much riding on that one question that suddenly I have no idea how to answer Jacob without it becoming a lie. I hesitate and then take a deep breath. "Hello. My name is Inigo Montoya," I murmur to Jacob. "You killed my father. Prepare to die." I know he's grinning as I stand up and face the jury. During a trial, lawyers ask the jury to see in shades of gray. You're supposed to look at both sides of an issue, to not prejudge anything, to wait until you've heard all the evidence to make a decision. The judge has instructed you to do this, and will instruct you to do this again at the end of the trial. I walk toward them. But Jacob Hunt doesn't know how to do that. He can't see shades of gray. To him, the world is black or white. For example, if you ask Jacob to pitch a tent, he will toss it at you. Part of Jacob's diagnosis with Asperger's syndrome means that he won't understand the concept of a metaphor. To him, the world is a literal place. I glance over my shoulder at Jacob, who's staring down at the table. You might have also noticed that yesterday, during this trial, Jacob didn't look the witnesses in the eye, or that he didn't show much emotion when the prosecution enumerated the horrors of a murder scene, or that he might not be able to sit through testimony for long periods of time and needs a break in that room in the back. In fact, there may be many moments during this trial where it seems to you that Jacob is acting rudely or immaturely, or even in a manner that makes him appear guilty. But ladies and gentlemen, Jacob cannot help it. Those behaviors are all hallmarks of Asperger's syndrome, a neurological disorder on the autism spectrum with which Jacob's been diagnosed. People with Asperger's might have a normal or even exceptional IQ, but will also show severe deficiencies in social and communication skills. They might be obsessed by routine or rules, or be fixated on a certain subject. They can't read expressions very well, or body language. They are overly sensitive to lights, textures, smells, and sounds. You are going to hear from Jacob's doctors and his mother about his limitations, and how they've tried hard to help Jacob overcome them. Part of what you're going to hear is Jacob's very concrete sense of what's right and what's wrong. In his world, rules are not just important, they're infallible. And yet, he has no understanding of the underlying bases of those rules. He can't tell you how his behavior might affect another person, because it is impossible for Jacob to put himself in someone else's metaphorical shoes. He might be able to recite to you every line from Crime Busters episode 44, but he can't tell you why the mother is upset in scene 7 of the show, or how the loss of a child impacted the parents in that show. If you ask Jacob, he can't explain it. Not because he doesn't want to, and not because he's a sociopath, but because his brain simply doesn't function that way. I walk behind the defense table and put my hand lightly on Jacob's shoulder. Immediately he flinches, just like I figured, beneath the jury's watchful eye. If you spend some time with Jacob, I say, you'll probably think there's something different about him. Something you can't quite put your finger on. He may seem odd or quirky, but you probably also won't think of him as insane. After all, he can hold a legitimate conversation with you. He knows more about certain subjects than I'll ever know. He isn't running around listening to voices in his head or setting small animals on fire. But the definition of legal insanity, ladies and gentlemen, is very different than what we typically think of when we think of the word insanity. It says that at the moment an act was committed, the defendant, as a result of a severe mental disease or defect, was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his acts. What that means is that a person with a neurological disorder like Asperger's who commits a crime, a person like Jacob, can't be held responsible in the same way you or I should be held responsible. And what you will hear from the witnesses for the defense is proof that having Asperger's syndrome makes it impossible for Jacob to understand how his actions might cause harm to someone else. You will hear how having Asperger's syndrome might lead a person like Jacob to have an idiosyncratic interest that becomes overwhelming and obsessive. And you will see, ladies and gentlemen, that having Asperger's syndrome impaired Jacob's ability to understand that what he did to Jess Ogilvy was wrong. Behind me, I hear whispering. From the corner of my eye, I see a dozen notes stacked on my side of the defense table. Jacob is rocking back and forth, his mouth tight. After a minute, he starts to write notes to Emma as well. No one is suggesting that Jess Ogilvie's death is anything less than a tragedy, and our sympathies must lie with her family. But don't compound that tragedy by creating a second victim. I nod and sit back down at the table. The notes are brief and angry. No. You have to tell them. What I did was right. I lean toward my client. Just trust me, I say.
Theo. Yesterday I was sitting alone in the back of the courtroom, squished between a woman who was knitting a newborn baby cap and a man in a tweed jacket who kept texting on his phone during the testimony. No one knew who I was, and I liked it that way. After Jacob's first sensory break, when I went to the little curtained room and the bailiff let me slip inside, my secret identity was not so much of a secret anymore. The knitting woman, I noticed, moved to a spot on the other side of the courtroom, as if I had some dread contagious disease, instead of just a last name shared with the defendant. The man in the tweed coat, though, stopped texting. He kept asking me questions. Had Jacob ever been violent before? Did he have the hots for Jess Ogilvie? Did she turn him down? It didn't take long for me to figure out that he was some kind of reporter, and after that, I just stood in the back near one of the bailiffs. Today, I'm sitting next to my father, a guy I don't know at all. When Oliver starts talking, my father leans toward me. What do you know about this guy? He likes long walks on the beach, and he's a Scorpio, I say. Here's what I really know. Oliver was rubbing my mom's arm today. Not in the, oh, you're about to fall, are you okay way, but in a sweet child of mine mode. What the fuck is that all about? He's supposed to be saving my brother's ass, not hitting on my mother. I know I should be relieved that my father is here, but actually I'm not. I'm sitting here wondering why we are spectators in a murder trial instead of on the first baseline at Fenway watching the Sox play. I'm wondering how I learned to tie a tie like I did for Jacob today, considering that my own father wasn't the one to teach it to me. I'm wondering why sharing the same DNA with a person doesn't make you automatically feel like you have something in common. As soon as Oliver finishes his statement, I turn to my father. I don't know how to fish, I say. I mean, I wouldn't know how to stick a worm on a hook, or how to use a pole, or anything like that. He just stares at me, frowning a little. It would have been cool if we'd fished, I say. You know, like in that pond behind the school. This, of course, is just plain stupid. I was 6 months old when my father left us. I could barely hold myself upright, much less a fishing pole. My father ducks his head. I get seasick, he says. Even just standing on a dock. Always have. After that, we don't really talk at all.
This ends Disc 15. House Rules, Disc 16.
I went to Dr. Moon once. My mother thought it would be a good idea for me to talk to a shrink about feelings I might be having, given the fact that my brother sucked up all the time and energy in our household like some giant karmic Hoover. I can't say I remember much about her, except that she smelled like incense and told me I could take off my shoes, because she herself could think better without shoes, and maybe I would too. On the other hand, I do still remember what we talked about. She said that sometimes It would be hard for me to be the younger brother because I had to do all the stuff the older brother usually did. She told me that this might frustrate Jacob and make him mad, and that would make him act even more immature. In this, she was the psychological equivalent of a weather forecast. She could tell me with precise probability what was coming, but she was completely unequipped to help me prepare for the storm. She looks different on the witness stand than she does when she's at her office. For example, she's wearing a business suit, and her crazy long hair is tamed into a bun. Oh, and she's wearing shoes. At first, Jacob was diagnosed with general autism spectrum disorder. Then we tweaked his diagnosis to pervasive developmental disorder. It wasn't until sixth grade that we amended his diagnosis to Asperger's syndrome, based on his inability to interpret social cues and to interact with peers in spite of his high IQ and verbal ability. For kids Jacob's age, that progression of diagnoses is very common. It doesn't mean he didn't always have Asperger's. He did. It just means that we didn't necessarily have the correct language to label it. Can you give a definition of Asperger's syndrome for people who aren't familiar with it, doctor? Oliver asks. It's a developmental disorder that affects the way information is processed in the brain, and it's considered to fall at the upper end of the autism spectrum. People with Asperger's are often very intelligent and very competent. In this, they differ from profoundly autistic children who can't communicate at all. But they have crippling disabilities in the area of social interaction. So someone with Asperger's might be smart. Someone with Asperger's might even have a genius-level IQ. However, when it comes to making small talk, he'll be completely inept. He has to be taught social interaction as if it's a foreign language, the way you or I would need to be taught Farsi. Lawyers sometimes have trouble finding friends, Oliver says, raising some laughter on the jury. Does that mean we all have Asperger's? No, Dr. Moon responds. A person with Asperger's desperately wants to fit in, but simply can't understand social behavior that's intuitive to the rest of us. He won't be able to read gestures or facial expressions to assess the mood of the person he's speaking to. He won't be able to interpret a nonverbal cue, such as a yawn signifying boredom when he's hogging the conversation. He won't be able to understand what someone else is thinking or feeling. That kind of empathy is unnatural to him. He truly is the center of his own universe and will react based on that principle. For example, I had a patient who caught his sister shoplifting and ratted her out. Not because he thought he was morally responsible to report his sister's crime, but because he didn't want to be known as the boy whose sister had a criminal record. Whatever a child with Asperger's does, he does because he's thinking of how it will affect him, not anyone else. Are there other hallmarks of the disorder? Yes. Someone with Asperger's might have difficulty organizing and prioritizing rules and tasks. He'll tend to focus on details instead of the big picture, and often will become obsessed for months or years at a time by one specific subject. And he can talk about that subject, even if it's a sophisticated topic, for hours at a time. For this reason, the disorder is sometimes referred to as the little professor syndrome. Children with Asperger's speak in such an adult manner, they often get along better with their parents' friends than with their own peers. Does Jacob have that sort of obsessive focus on one subject? Oh, yes. He's had several over the years. Dogs and dinosaurs, and most recently, forensic science. What else might we notice about a person with Asperger's syndrome? He'll adhere slavishly to routine and rules. He's painfully honest. He will dislike making eye contact. He might have hypersensitivity to light or noise or touch or taste. For example, right now, Jacob is probably working very hard to block out the sound of the fluorescent lights in this courtroom, which you and I can't even hear. One moment, a child with Asperger's might present as an extremely bright, if awkward, child,
And the next? When his routine is disrupted, he might have a meltdown that lasts between 10 minutes and several hours.
Like a toddler's tantrum?
Exactly. Except it's a lot more debilitating when the child is 18 and 180 pounds, Dr. Moon says.
I can feel my father staring at me, so I turn to him.
Does that happen a lot? He whispers. The tantrums?
You get used to it, I say, although I'm not sure this is true. In reality, you don't ever change the hurricane. You just learn how to stay out of its path. Oliver is walking toward the jury now. Will Jacob ever be cured of Asperger's?
At present, the shrink says, there's no cure for autism. It's not something you outgrow. It's a condition you have forever.
Dr. Morano, which of the symptoms you've related here today has Jacob manifested over the years?
All of them, she says. Even now, at age 18?
Jacob's gotten much better at rolling with the punches if a routine is disrupted. Although it's still upsetting, now he has coping mechanisms he can draw upon. Instead of having a screaming fit, like he did at age 4, he'll find a song or a movie and repeat the lyrics or lines over and over.
Doctor, this court has allowed Jacob to take sensory breaks when necessary. Can you explain what that is?
It's a way for Jacob to get away from the overstimulation that's upsetting him. When he feels like he's spiraling out of control, he can remove himself and go to a place that's quiet and less chaotic. In school, he has a room where he can pull himself together again, and in court, he has the same type of area. Inside are all sorts of materials that Jacob can use to calm himself down, from deep pressure weighted blankets to a rope swing to fiber optic lamps.
You said that kids with Asperger's have an affinity for rules. Is that true of Jacob?
Yes. For example, Jacob knows that school starts at 8:12 a.m., and because of that rule, he is on time every day. However, one week his mother told him that he would be late for school because he had a dentist appointment. He had a meltdown, put his fist through a wall in his bedroom, and couldn't be calmed down enough to be taken to the dentist. In Jacob's mind, he was being asked to break a rule.
He punched a wall.
Do kids with Asperger's have a propensity for violence? Oliver asks. That's a myth. In fact, a child with Asperger's is more likely to not misbehave than neurotypical children are, simply because he knows that's the rule. However, a child with Asperger's also has a very low fight-or-flight threshold. If he feels cornered in any way, verbally, physically, or emotionally, he might either run or strike out blindly.
Have you ever seen Jacob do that?
Yes, Dr. Moon says. At school last year, he was given detention for swearing at a teacher. Apparently, a young woman tricked him into behaving inappropriately by saying she'd be his friend if he did it. Afterward, he retaliated by shoving her and was suspended.
What triggered the violent response in Jacob?
Being belittled, I imagine.
Did you talk to him about the episode?
Oliver asks.
I did.
Did you explain why his violent response wasn't appropriate?
Yes.
Do you think he understood that what he did was wrong?
She hesitates.
Jacob's sense of right and wrong isn't based on an internalized moral code. It's based on what he's been told to do or not to do. If you asked him whether it's right to hit someone, he would tell you no. However, he would also tell you that it's wrong to make fun of someone, and in his mind, the young woman broke that rule first. When Jacob hit her, he wasn't thinking of how he might hurt her, or even of how his actions might be going against a rule of behavior. He was thinking of how she'd hurt him, and he simply reacted.
Oliver approaches the witness stand. Dr. Morano,
If I told you that Jacob had argued with Jess Ogilvy 2 days before she died, and that she'd told him to get lost, how would you think that had affected his behavior? She shakes her head. Jess was very important to Jacob, and if they had a fight, he would have been extremely upset. In going to her house that day, he was clearly manifesting that he didn't know how to behave. He stuck to his routine rather than let the argument run its course. Most likely, Jacob's mind processed the fight like this. Jess told me to get lost. I can't possibly get lost because I always know where I am. Therefore, she didn't really mean what she said, so I'll just go on as if she never said it. Jacob would not have understood from Jess's language that she might truly not have wanted to see him. It's this inability to put himself in Jess's frame of mind that separates Jacob from his peers. Whereas another child may just be socially awkward, Jacob is disassociated entirely from empathy, and his actions and perceptions revolve around his own needs. He never stopped to imagine what Jess was feeling. All he knew was how much she was hurting him by arguing with him. Does Jacob know that it's against the law to commit murder? Absolutely. With his fixation on forensic criminology, he probably could recite the legal statutes as well as you could, Mr. Bond. But for Jacob, self-preservation is the one inviolable rule, the one that trumps everything else. So just like he lost his temper with the girl at school who'd humiliated him, and truly didn't understand why that was problematic given what she'd done to him first, well, I can only imagine that's what happened with Jess, too. Suddenly, Jacob stands up. I didn't lose my temper, he shouts as my mother grabs his arm to make him sit down again. Of course, the fact that he's losing his temper at this very second sort of negates what he's saying. Control your client, Mr. Bond, the judge warns. When Oliver turns around, he looks the way soldiers do in movies when they crest a hill and see a swarm of enemy forces below them, and realize that no matter what, they don't have a prayer. Jacob, he sighs. Sit down. I need a break, Jacob yells. Oliver looks at the judge. Your Honor? And then suddenly, the jury is being let out and Jacob is practically running to the sensory break room. My father looks completely lost. What happens now? We wait 15 minutes. Should I? Are you going to go back there with them? I have, every time so far. I've hung out in a corner, playing with some koosh balls, while Jacob gets his act together. But now, I glance up at my father. Do what you want, I say. I'm staying here. In my first memory, I'm really sick and I can't stop crying. Jacob is around 6 or 7, and he keeps asking my mother, who's been up with me all night, to get breakfast ready. It's early. The sun hasn't even come up yet. I'm hungry, Jacob says. I know, but I have to take care of Theo right now. What's the matter with Theo? His throat hurts. Very bad. There's a moment where Jacob takes this information in. I bet if he had ice cream, his throat would feel better. Jacob, my mother says, stunned. You're thinking about how Theo feels? I don't want his throat to hurt, Jacob says. Ice cream! Ice cream! I yell. It's not even really ice cream that I'm screaming for. It's soy-based, like everything else in the freezer and fridge, but it's still something that's supposed to be a treat, not a breakfast food. My mother gives in. Okay. Ice cream, she says. She puts me in my booster seat and gives me a bowl. She gives Jacob a bowl, too, and pats his head. I'm going to have to tell Dr. Moon that you were looking out for your brother, she says. Jacob eats his ice cream. Finally, he says, peace and quiet. My mother still holds that up as an example of Jacob transcending his Asperger's to exhibit empathy for his poor, sick kid brother. Here's what I see now that I'm older. Jacob got a bowl of ice cream for breakfast and didn't even have to be the one to beg for it. Jacob got me to stop making a racket. My brother wasn't trying to help me that day. He was trying to help himself.
Jacob. I'm lying underneath the blanket that feels like 100 hands pressing down on me, like I'm deep at the bottom of the sea and can't see the sun or hear what's happening on the shore.